Next case on our calendar, 001705, City of Cincinnati versus Beretta USA Corporation. Mr. DeMarco.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Paul DeMarco, Waitschneider, Bayless, and Chesley for the plaintiff, City of Cincinnati. With me today at council table are Stanley Chesley, Michael Barrett, and Gene Geppinger. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor. Cincinnati appeals the dismissal of its claims under Rule 12b-6. This court has held that such dismissals are unusual and require great caution. Under the syllabus of O'Brien, such a dismissal can only be granted when it is beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts consistent with the complaint that would entitle it to relief. All the allegations must be accepted as true. All reasonable inferences must be drawn in the plaintiff's favor. Judge Ruhlman in the Court of Appeals did not follow these rules in hastily dismissing Cincinnati's claims, and that's particularly evident on the public nuisance claim. Despite defendants' recasting of it, public nuisance has never meant anything more than an unreasonable interference with a right common to the general public. The complaint clearly alleges unreasonable and continuing interference with the Cincinnati public's right to safety and peace, for which these defendants are at least partly responsible. As Americans, we understand.
The lead opinion and the concurring opinion of Judge Painter.
Yes.
Talk about the remoteness doctrine and the public expenditure doctrine.
Right.
If there's no cause of action vis-a-vis those two issues, then 12b-6 would be appropriate, wouldn't it?
It would, Your Honor. Let me take each of those issues. I'll take the second one first.
Those are our two issues, and you might contrast it with the tobacco cases. Immediately when I saw this, I thought about the tobacco cases.
Right.
So I went directly to that point and find in Judge Painter's concurring opinion that he talks about the tobacco cases, but frankly, I don't understand what he says.
Right. On the remoteness issue, you're correct that the Court of Appeals did seize on that issue, as did Judge Ruhlman. As recently as yesterday, the Supreme Court of Connecticut also seized on that issue. But let me talk about that in the context of public nuisance and why remoteness is improperly injected into the public nuisance equation. Was by the Court of Appeals, was by yesterday by the Connecticut Supreme Court. Remoteness, as a tort doctrine, arises in some negligence cases, but here's why it doesn't apply to nuisance. This court, for example, has held, let's take the Fankhauser scenario, the inoperative traffic signal. That is an interference with the public right, the public safety. Now, the city doesn't have to wait until a city truck has an accident because of the malfunctioning traffic light. It is, per se, a nuisance because it causes a danger to the public safety and order. Let's take the scenario of the Queen City Terminal case, even though that wasn't dealing with nuisance, but depositing a carcinogen that gets into the sewer system. First of all, if the remoteness doctrine applied to such a nuisance claim, the city could never bring it. The city is the proper party to assert the rights of the general public. The city, after all, can't get cancer in my hypothetical. So when the Connecticut Supreme Court yesterday and when this Court of Appeals injected remoteness into it, they acted improperly. Remoteness should not be a part of a public nuisance claim. Once the court finds that the plaintiff has alleged a damage to a right common to the general public, an unreasonable interference. Now, clearly we did.
We have to find then that the public nuisance doctrine would apply, or the cause of action would apply, and that would negate the remoteness doctrine, the public expenditure doctrine?
I think it does. I think it simply doesn't apply to the public nuisance doctrine. And let me give you another reason why it didn't. And it deals with what this court has said specifically about gun accessibility. In Mosier versus Dayton, the city there was attempting to keep dangerous weapons out of the hands of criminals and minors, precisely what we're doing. There, this court said that was a proper police power objective. In Arnold versus City of Cleveland, the court went a step further. The court said that not only is it a proper police power objective, it is a mandate. So on the one hand, we have the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of Connecticut saying remoteness has a role in public nuisance. And on the other hand, we have this court saying, well, wait a minute, the city's responsibility, the city's mandate, part of it is to protect the public against the accessibility of firearms and the danger that that poses. Now, what danger does that pose in Cincinnati? And here again, we have to come back to, is there no set of facts that could support that claim? Consider the facts about Cincinnati. Consider the public nuisance in Cincinnati, this black market in handguns and the effects that it has on Cincinnati. In a four-month period, 107 shootings, 13 on one street, 4 on one block, 200 police calls for shots fired in 8 days, 32 responses by the police to shooting in progress. The police so overwhelmed that that homicide cops are working 29-hour shifts. City official
isn't
calls
the problem,
it the
problem, counsel. I'm
pardon
sorry,
me.
Over here.
Yes.
Isn't there somewhat of a problem with your theory in that these this nuisance requires the requires criminals, third parties, to act. So it's the objection with regard to the distribution and availability of guns doesn't lie, that nuisance doesn't lie or is not controlled by the parties that you have sued. It's third parties acting independently and not controlled by these parties. Isn't that a particular problem with your theory?
Actually, I don't think it is, Your Honor, and for this reason, it is all in how you define the nuisance. First of all, the nuisance here is the black market that is created that supplies handguns to minors and criminals.
And the defendants do not control that black market.
Well, actually, Your Honor, we allege that they did, and they do. If you look at paragraph 79 of the complaint, you see our allegation of control. Now, I'm not conceding that control is the standard for liability for public nuisance, because the restatement tells us the standard is, did they create or contribute to the public nuisance? That's the standard that's applied under the Ohio statute. I believe the Packrats case applies a slightly different standard, knowledge and participation. We have alleged all of those things in our complaint, Your Honor, to cover all of those bases. Now, whether that proves out in the end is subject to discovery, and of course, I can't tell you everything there is to know about the control that the defendants have.
We have to assume you can prove it, and,
right.
and we're operating under that set of norms here.
That's right.
We assume you can prove it.
Right.
But the flaw lies in the case that you say you might prove.
Right. I think if you look no further than paragraph 76, which is Smith and Wesson's own vice president telling the story of the defendant's knowledge of this black market, know that they are operating as its feeder system, they know the consequences of it are criminal misuse of handguns, that all of those things together under the restatement standard creating, contributing to the Packrat standard, knowledge or participation in, all of those things are covered by that allegation. That's
so
paragraph 76.
If we followed you, I'm trying to go beyond this case and to the principle of law. If we followed that rationale, then a distiller of alcoholic beverages would be liable for the tavern owner who negligently, or let's use a nuisance, puts a lot of alcohol into young kids who go out and drive their cars into other people. Would that be the same theory then? The fact that they know about it,
right,
distiller knows about it, has some obligation to stop the tavern owner from misusing the distiller's product.
Yeah. Your Honor, I think if it actually exists as a recognized black market, then operating as the feeder system for the black market is what we're talking about in this case. Let me give you an example that I think is a real-life example. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms notifies gun manufacturers when one of their guns is used in a crime. As we point out, this happens to these defendants on average one every 15 minutes. And what happens is they're notified of the crime. They know, as the manufacturer who put it into the distribution system, they know who the distributor was. Now, under that scenario, if you keep hearing distributor A, that gun led to a crime, distributor A, that gun led to a crime, distributor A, and you never hear about distributor B, C, and D, what you have is a situation where they know that their distribution practice to distributor A is causing these handguns to fall into that market, and they are being used for crimes. That's the problem. We want to stop distributor A.
Okay, why wouldn't that, I follow you, why wouldn't that be a negligence theory rather than nuisance?
Well, it certainly is a negligent enabling theory, just like if you were to provide your car keys to somebody that you know is going to drive drunk. I think under the restatement, because there is a public right involved, the public's right right to security and safety has been destroyed. That fits squarely under the nuisance claim. And the restatement tells us under 821C, comment A, when there's been a public right that's been interfered with, redress of that wrong falls to the duly authorized representatives of the citizenry. In that case, this is the city. And to get back to the question that was raised by Justice Douglas about expenditure of funds, I think we have to look at what that City of Flagstaff case actually says, because that's really the seminal case in this area. Very carefully read, that case says that we do not apply this. First of all, we do not apply this because of any notion of remoteness. So it takes remoteness away from that idea that a city cannot recover any municipal costs. And then it says something significant. We also recognize that public nuisance cases brought by government entities are not part of this rule. This rule does not apply to public nuisance cases, not brought by public entities. So I think that's the answer to your question, Justice Douglas, first of all, remoteness is different from the inability to recover public funds. And in this situation, because we have alleged the interference with a public right, that being public safety, we get around that rule.
I suppose you have to talk about the merits by necessity to formulate this for us, but this is still a 12B6 case.
That's correct.
And Chief Justice has asked you about the negligence theory. I was going to do that too, because that it seems like the gun manufacturer you're talking about maybe is under a negligence cause of action. We've talked about the public nuisance. How does it tie into product liability?
Well, I think it ties into product liability in this way. Certainly we're on firmest footing when we talk about public nuisance, because there you have the public right that's recognized. The interference gives rise to the claim. But under the Perkins versus Wilkinson sword case, I don't think there's any question that this is a preventable danger, despite the fact, as in Perkins, that it is being used for the intended purpose, in that case to start a fire, in this case to kill. The problem is that there are safety measures that they could take that would prevent those dangers, as in Perkins. Now, what could they take? The Justice Department has talked about two ways to go about that in their recent reports. First of all, they could address the distribution system, but that's more of a theory under the injunctive relief for public nuisance. But what could they do?
Now you're talking about the merits again.
Yes.
We're just trying to determine 12B6 and/or does a cause of action lie?
Right.
Are you saying the cause of action lies under the codified provisions of the product liability law in Ohio?
I think it does, Your Honor, and for this reason. As I said, we're on firmest footing with public nuisance. But under the statute, and remembering under Correll that the common law still lives in products liability, that we have a situation where the product as defined in Perkins and in prior cases that are cited in Perkins is defective because of, as I've just said, it is a it lacks a safety feature that could prevent its unauthorized use. However, we come to the issue then, logically, of what's the city's standing to bring a product liability claim. And here, I think, as Justice Holmes said, the genius of the common law is to be able to adapt to the changing circumstances of modern society. Now,
excuse me, counsel, but the city is seeking to recover the costs that it has to expend because of the product being in the marketplace. That's economic loss, isn't it, counsel? And the Products Liability Act does not provide for damages for purely economic loss.
Right. The city is primarily, just to be clear, the city is primarily focusing first on the injunctive relief that it seeks, second on damages that it seeks under the public nuisance doctrine, and then under the remaining claims like negligent enabling and the product liability case. We do not believe in this instance that it is solely economic damage, because the city has been damaged both in its property and in its ability.
Under the products liability claim. Under the products liability claim.
Right.
You have to be seeking damages.
Yes, and we are seeking damages in part under the products liability claim in addition to the other claims. The damage in this case is not just to how the city must do its business, as I referred to before, the way it must change the way it polices the community, but also the damage that the city incurs as a result of the interference with its right and the fact that these guns are designed in a way that unauthorized users can use them. I think what has to be fleshed out and the challenge for the court to adapt is the right that we've talked about, the public right, the public's right to security and safety, the public's right not to have its public property damaged by the unauthorized accessibility of handguns, is that enough of a damage under product liability law to sustain this cause of action? As I said, the genius of the common law is that it adapts to these things. 3 weeks ago, our concept of collective security and public rights was less than it was than it is today. But I think today we understand better that that an injury done to collective security is an injury done to an entire community. And here, the only party that's appropriate...
You need to wrap up, Mr. DeMarco.
Yes, Your Honor. The only party that's appropriate is the city. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Doerr.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Doerr. I would like to divide our time between myself and my colleague, Mr. Fennell. I would like to address the substantive individual causes of action. Mr. Fennell will address the overarching issues of remoteness and cost recovery.
Counsel, what exactly do they seek in injunctive relief?
In the wherefore clause of the complaint, Your Honor, in injunctive relief, among the things the plaintiff seeks is a complete alteration to the way in which a lawful product, here firearms, are sold and distributed throughout the United States. If you look at the wherefore clause, the plaintiff asks that there be modifications to the system of distribution of firearms so that they are sold in a different means than the means that are already provided for under federal law.
They're asking a trial court in Cincinnati to redesign the distribution system for the entire United States.
That's correct. That's exactly what they're asking, and that's one of the faults of the nuisance theory here among the many. They're taking what's basically a local remedy and trying to apply it nationally, and if each city of Toledo were permitted to do something different, if Detroit were permitted to do something different, we would have a number of municipalities seeking and perhaps obtaining inconsistent means of distributing a lawful product nationally. That was a concern of the Louisiana Supreme Court in the New Orleans case, the Morial case.
Secondly, when they say that they should do a different design so unlawful users can't use guns. What exactly do they mean? I mean, how does a criminal be prevented from using the gun that a legitimate owner can actually use? I didn't understand how they envisioned that product design.
I don't either, Your Honor. A product has to be able to function. For example, in the Perkins case, that involved a lighter. In order to be the product that it is as a lighter, the user has to be able to get a flame with that lighter. As the court noted in Perkins, that is an inherent characteristic of the product. With a firearm, an inherent characteristic of the product is the ability to shoot. And no court in this country has held that a product liability action, for example, is valid in a situation where a criminal intentionally uses a product to commit homicide. That's not what product liability is about. Perkins applies to individual, particularized circumstances, such as accidents which occur with a product, and if there were an accident and an individual is hurt with a firearm and they claim a particular design defect, such as a magazine disconnect, as is claimed here, then that case is viable. There's no threat to individual rights for appropriate product liability cases here. But what the plaintiff seeks go beyond that.
One more question. I'll let you go for a while. How many of these type of lawsuits have been brought nationally?
There have been approximately 20 of them. A couple have been consolidated. The number is 20, involving approximately 32 or so municipalities, but a number of those suits have been consolidated.
And how many of them have concluded in one form or fashion?
How many what?
Have concluded by summary or by other methods?
There have been decisions at least the trial level in 15 of those cases, and 9 of them have been completely dismissed. 3 of them have been partially dismissed, either negligence or nuisance counts. 3 of them, including the Cleveland case, which Judge Nugent decided in federal court, have been allowed to proceed. At the appellate level, there have been, in the municipal litigation, there was a decision yesterday mentioned by counsel of the Connecticut Supreme Court dismissing the case, a decision by the Louisiana Supreme Court dismissing the case. And I might note that the case most heavily relied upon by the plaintiffs in their briefs before the court, in their opening brief, the Hamilton case, which was a federal district court case by Judge Weinstein, has been soundly and unanimously rejected under its theories, the same theories that are being espoused here by the New York Court of Appeals.
That sounds exactly like the same procedural history in the tobacco cases to me. When I was in practice for a long period of time, we always flirted with that cause of action, knowing there was some problem with tobacco. But we always came down on the side, well, it's a legal product, and therefore nobody can do anything. That's had a whole evolutionary change, and I'm wondering why, because I really didn't understand what Judge Painter was saying. He just sort of said it's not like the tobacco cases because it isn't. Why isn't it?
It's not like tobacco in a number of respects. What we're talking about here, Your Honor, is solely the distribution issue, leaving aside the strict liability claim for a minute, which we've discussed. We're talking about the distribution of a lawful product pursuant to extensive federal laws and regulations. There is no allegation here that any of the manufacturers have done anything unlawful or illegal. As a matter of fact, the allegation of the complaint is that the manufacturers have done what they're required to do by law. Federal law says manufacturers cannot sell across state lines directly to consumers. Manufacturers sell, as alleged in the complaint, to distributors who are also federally licensed. That's a lawful sale mandated by federal law. And then the distributors sell to retailers who in turn sell under an extensive set of regulations, including a requirement for FBI approval before the sale is made to a consumer.
Much the same with tobacco. They can sell a legal product, but they have to put a warning on the package. And then when it gets there, they can't sell it to minors. I mean, the same sort of regulations entail with that, and I don't see the distinction.
But you're dealing here in tobacco with the fact that the claim is that each cigarette is harmful to human health, causing injury to the public, and there is support for that. A firearm is a lawful product recognized under the laws of and provided for under both federal, state, and local law for the provision of this lawful product, which is lawful for people to own and use, and does not in and of itself cause harm to anyone. So if the court were to permit this kind of claim to be made in this case, you would be going down the slippery slope of saying an alcoholic beverage manufacturer who also operates under laws, makes a perfectly lawful product designed for human consumption and use, would be held liable under the very theories espoused here for the misuse of alcohol within the city of Cincinnati, for drunk driving perhaps, for intoxicated persons getting it, for children using false ID, obtaining alcohol when they should not. The same thing with automobile manufacturers who have a generalized awareness, the same type of generalized awareness that's alleged here, that their automobiles are going to be involved in accidents. And therefore, there would be circumstances, you would be permitting, there's no principled basis for distinguishing between those circumstances and the circumstances here. I do need to let my colleague proceed. I would like to just say one other thing. On the nuisance claim, there are a number of areas in which that claim does not state a cause of action, one of which is that the law of Ohio, just as the restatement of torts, requires that there be an underlying tort, that there be either intentional or unlawful conduct and ultra-hazardous activity which gives rise to absolute liability, or negligence which underlies the nuisance claim. And that is clearly not present here. As we've set forth at length in our briefs, there is no duty under the law of Ohio, either under a negligence theory or under a nuisance theory.
Thank you, Mr. Doerr. Mr. Fennell.
May it please the court, Tom Fennell, arguing this motion on behalf of the defendants. There was reference in plaintiff's argument to a new case that was handed down yesterday. We had called the plaintiffs to make sure they had a copy and whether they had any difficulty in our reference to it. They did not, and they have obviously already referred to it. But before referring to that case, I would like to make sure, Chief Justice, since the rules of the court provide that we are only to refer to authority submitted to the court within 7 days, that I do have permission to refer to that case yesterday.
Some counsel, you can submit it to the clerk's office after.
This case that was decided yesterday is an extremely important case. It is a municipal firearm case identical to, or virtually identical to, the case that is now before this court. The Connecticut Supreme Court, as your honors will see, spent a great deal of time describing the allegations of the plaintiffs in that Connecticut action, the Bridgeport case. And those allegations, if anything, were even stronger than the allegations in this complaint, which of course is our frame of reference for this motion. It also represents the first state Supreme Court to address these issues in this litigation. The Louisiana Supreme Court, of course, addressed issues related to the effect of a statute that barred the municipal suit. But here, this was the first state Supreme Court to address the very issues that are before this court and some other issues that have been dropped by the plaintiffs. It was a unanimous decision of the Connecticut Supreme Court. And its principal grounds were the grounds of the direct injury requirement of, in that case, standing, although the analysis in that case, and the analysis, as the court knows, of direct injury in the standing context and the direct injury element of proximate cause is essentially the same. And the court discusses it that way in the opinion. a very important ruling. Indeed, it was the appellants who, in this argument and just the argument a few moments ago, said that the principal focus of their argument here is their public nuisance claim. And a public nuisance claim was, in fact, made before the Connecticut Supreme Court. And quoting from that opinion, the court said, "Moreover, we found no case, and the plaintiffs have suggested none, in which a plaintiff situated as remotely from the defendant's conduct as these plaintiffs are, and who presented a chain of causation as lengthy and multifaceted as these plaintiffs have, nonetheless has been able to have standing to assert a public nuisance claim." The court stated that, and I quote again, "the remoteness doctrine as a limitation on standing premised on policy reasons cuts across and applies to all of the plaintiff's substantive claims, including their public nuisance claim." This was a significant opinion. It spends a great deal of time analyzing the direct injury requirement of proximate cause, and I recommend it to the court as guidance in this area. I want to direct...
I would say, and it would seem to me it would be your position then, that no cause of action under any circumstances could ever be properly stated in the design, marketing, or distribution of a dangerous instrumentality such as a gun.
No, I wouldn't.
It becomes absolute.
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far. I think proximate cause, which has two elements to it, as Your Honor knows, one of which is the length of chain, and the other is the indirect or derivative injury aspect, applies in cases like this. And in fact, I wanted to go to your question about the tobacco litigation. You know, there's this new breed of litigation, and we have seen it start to roll here, where governments joining together with plaintiff's lawyers have sought reimbursement for government costs. And in those cases, there are two aspects of those cases which are causing those cases to fail. One is the very long chains that are involved in those. They're seeking to strike at a manufacturer in a long distribution chain. And the second is they're seeking derivative injuries. They're seeking cost reimbursement. In this case, the plaintiffs like to claim, for example, that they're seeking to vindicate a public interest. You know, this is a public nuisance. But the city has brought a claim for damage to itself. It has claimed damages that are economic losses for cost reimbursement. And if you parse through the restatement, by the way, on that issue, you will see that under the restatement, while a government body may have the right to seek out and abate a public nuisance, in order for it to obtain damages, you have to have damages that are unique and different.
But the state of Ohio claimed economic damage in the tobacco litigation.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to address the tobacco litigation. In fact, as we cite in our brief, Justice Sweeney, in the tobacco litigation, there was uniform dismissal of those cases, in the Union Trust Fund cases, in the Guatemala case, the country cases, in the municipality cases, in the Washington Public Hospital cases where they claim that they were subdivisions of the state. In all of those cases, and we cite them in the briefs, they were dismissed by those federal courts of appeals. The exception, I think, that may be bothering Your Honor is there were a few state attorney general cases that were not dismissed. And I think if you carefully look at those cases, and they have been distinguished by these other cases that are cited in our brief. In the one case, for example, in Florida, where the issue was raised, there was a specific statute that was passed by the Florida legislature to allow that suit to proceed and to abrogate common law defenses. It was very clear that it was abrogating common law defenses. There was a constitutional challenge to that. There's a history to that litigation.
Yeah, but that would have been okay for cases in the future, but not in the past. Let me finish with that issue, if you will, please. Does that mean that if the tobacco companies, in your judgment, does that mean if the tobacco companies had chosen, instead of settling, to litigate to the end? And, you know, I read not as much as you do, maybe, on that issue, but lots. And it seems to me that a number of people on the other side said, wait a minute, let's litigate this to the end, we're going to win. Is that your position? Because there would be no, public nuisance?
Well, Your Honor...
It's a legal product, properly distributed.
Your Honor, I have some strong feelings about whether or not that litigation ought to have been continued. But somewhat beside the point, because the state AG litigation is distinguishable, not only because of the specific statutes, as in the Florida case, but there was crafted, for example, by the Texas judge in the Texas state AG case, a quasi-sovereign authority in that state that he said, now this is a district court case, lent authority for a state and only a state given its position to be able to bring the suit like the suit that was brought, that state, Texas state case. If you look at some of the cases in the Union Trust Fund area or involving municipalities or the hospital districts case, that Washington hospital districts case here, you will see there is a big distinction. Those cases are all dismissed. And in the Washington hospital case, their public nuisance claim was dismissed based on remoteness or the direct injury requirement. And in many of those cases, Justice Sweeney, they in fact talk about why the state AG cases are different. And they are different here because we're not talking about a state for one thing, but we're all, and there's a lot of other factual differences. I don't mean to say that there is a similarity. As my colleague, Mr. Doar, described, these cases are different factually as well.
Okay, have you used your time, Mr. Bennell?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. DeMarco, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds to start.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Stratton asked about the injunctive relief, and opposing counsel professed not to understand how the distribution system could be changed. Well, one of his clients has a program already. It's called Don't Lie for the Other Guy, and I got it off their website. They say the program is a response to the number of straw man purchases cited in recently issued ATF reports. The industry and ATF believe they can significantly reduce the number of illegally purchased firearms through a campaign of increased awareness and education. The Justice Department has said the same thing. Remember I talked about Distributor A. If you cut off Distributor A, there's your injunctive relief. Another program they've started goes to your other question about the design of the firearm. Taurus has started technology which they say is now sufficiently able to create a weapon that is personalized and only the authorized user can use. His clients have already started this, and we would enlarge it to all of the defendants.
Have you taken any depositions at all in this case?
We haven't taken a single deposition, and that goes back to your question about the tobacco cases. It is a lawful product like tobacco was a lawful product. I'm not prepared to concede at this point that all of their distribution practices have been lawful, however. Mr. Chesley and I handled a case a number of years ago, which was a nuisance case against a weapons manufacturer, a nuclear weapons manufacturer, for letting uranium go off the Fernald site.
You haven't taken any depositions?
No. And I'm saying, in the end, we found there was a law violated every day. I think we might find that in this case. But as York said, it's time to get to the next stage. Pleading is not the stage to prove the case.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco.
Thank
the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.